something that many people criticize me for being like a compliment, being a very cold nationalist, right? And maybe not appreciating the power of music. But I'm going to dispel that rumor. This is really not true. I very fundamentally understand how powerful music is. I experience it myself. And part of what I'm going to do is a little bit of an experiment, but I think it's okay, certainly for today. And we'll see if we're going to drop it all together. But I want to introduce the issue with a song that we're going to hear. And the words, anyone who knows I have the words, many of you might be familiar with the song. It's called The Deaf Man in the Shiva. And it has a certain agenda for me, right? It has an important message for the Zman. So that's like kind of why I'm doing it also. It has a Yom Kippur message, which is a nice side thing. But I have a very specific agenda, you'll see in a moment, hopefully, with this song. So everyone, look at the lyrics. I'm going to play the song because we want to get the power of Zemer generating our hearts as much as our minds. And we're going to see, somebody points out to me within this song is a very controversial statement that my secular anti-religious friends will pounce upon. Okay? Somebody point out, what am I referring to? Okay? Listen to the whole song. Right? There's a beautiful Yom Kippur message. It's really not what we're after, even though don't get confused. The Yom Kippur message is the ikar of this song. Right? We'll mention what that is. But I'm after something that comes in on the side, sneaks in, and is really a point of contention that's what we're going to be talking about. That's going to be the topic. So if I can get this to work. Check out the words. Thank you.
Okay. Nice song.
Has a nice Yom Kippur message. I'll just mention it quickly. It's not what we're really interested in, but since it's the Zman, who's the hero of this story? Who was heroic in the beginning of the song?
Father.
Of course, right? And what was he heroic? There he was. He couldn't hear a word. Didn't hear a word of his son, but he was obviously getting a lot of nachs from his kid, right? And he wanted to do anything he could show the kid how much he appreciated it. He would look for the motions. Couldn't hear a word, but he could see him. And he wanted to express for his kid how much he appreciated what he had become, etc., etc. And then it's a very, 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 very significant message at the end that the son sang so extra beautifully at the end. What was the impetus for the son singing so extra beautifully at the end?
His father could hear him for the first time.
Right. So what?
So, knowing that his father was now in heaven and could watch down and hear.
So there was an extra psych up for him, right? Yeah. There was an extra inspiration to really sing from the depths of his soul, right? That's a very important message for Yom Kippur because, you know, davening on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, if it's not genuine, right? If it's contrived performance, is an extremely dangerous thing to do. It's a big negative. The Gross says that a person who cries on Yom Kippur or on Rosh Hashanah is doing it there. It's a very, very strange statement for the Gross to make. Because Rosh Hashanah is supposed to be all about crying. The Arizal says, if a person doesn't cry on Rosh Hashanah, they lack shleimus. They're not a real, full, whole person. It's a very different take. So the way people explain the Gra is really in a difficult position because what's another name for Rosh Hashanah? What else? What is the Torah's name for Rosh Hashanah? Yom Tshuah. What does Yom Tshuah mean? What's the Targum say? Yom Yevava Yehei Lachom, which means crying. So how could the Gra say it's not, you're not allowed to cry? It's an Aveira. It's the opposite. The whole thing's about crying. What is the Shofar? What's a Tshuah? What does the Tshuah represent? Crying. Gonach. Groaning. Right? The whole idea is to cry. So the Talmidei Hagra explained what he's talking about is being disingenuous, being phony, false crying. He's saying the chazin that gets up there and is like putting on a show, thinking he's crying, he's not doing anyone a favor. Because if there's one thing that's central to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, it's emes, it's honesty, and it's like, tell it like it is, I am who I am. And it's all about emes. Anything that's contrived and phony is out the window. So the son was in a moment, you know, here he feels now finally, oh, my father can really hear me. This davening came so genuine from his heart that it was extremely moving to the entire audience. So it's a little Yom Kippur message, but there's something else hidden here that represents a confrontation, right? It's a point is being made in the song that Jews will be very comfortable with. Religious people will be very comfortable, not only Jews, but any religious person is going to be very comfortable with. But a real secular person, particularly a secular skeptic, a secular person who doubts the existence of God, who doubts the existence of religion, soul, all of it. What's that hidden point?
I just think that the father will be able to hear him because now he's dead.
What? Exactly. That's the point. Why should the father be able to hear him now? What changed? So, obviously, you all take it for granted. You know what changed? Well, his soul is freed up from the deathness, right? When the soul was in the body, then he was death. But now he gets out of that body, which is the limiting factor, and the soul itself can hear. In order to believe something like that, what do you have to believe? There is an existence of a soul independent of the body. That is a very hot, debated issue. Now, again, for a lot of you, you might never have thought of this, and it's a very dangerous topic. Right? I'm shuddering to bring it up. I spoke to many people about whether this was a good idea. The reason I decided it was is because I know I, in my life, have been confronted with it numerous times. When I was in college, right, and I didn't go to YU, but I think even if you go to YU, you're going to be confronted with this. But I was confronted it in college, I would say, every other course this came up. But the most significant time it came up was, I would say, about 16 years ago now. I was a cardiologist working in a hospital, And I had just finished my training. I was being trained by somebody who's probably like the number one, in my opinion, cardiologist in the entire country, right? Brilliant, absolutely brilliant person. And I had a very close relationship with him. He was like my Rebbe in cardiology, right? He was my mentor. And I remember he used to, all the time, kid me because he was an avowed atheist. He was one of these very super rationalist people who absolutely rejected the whole idea of religion, spirituality, thought it was ridiculous. So every now and then he would come over to me and he would say, you know, you're such a logical person when it comes to medicine, why do you lose your head when it comes to religion? So I would say to him, Dr. X, you're such a logical, smart person, why do you lose your head when it comes to religion? Right? And we'd go back and forth like that until finally we had substantive arguments. In other words, I said to him, I said, what's with you? What do you think happens after you die? That was my opening. I said, what do you think happens? So, you see what it says on this handout that you don't have? There is a word in the corner there. It says the word tape recorder. Why does it say, try to spread these out? These are the handouts for this course. What's tape recorder? That's what he told me. First of all, you guys know what a tape recorder is? I don't want to date myself too much, but everyone knows what a tape recorder is, right? So, it's not a joke question. I really think that a lot of people don't know what a tape recorder is. You don't see them too often, right? Tape recorder has tapes, it's a reel. So he told me the answer to this question, you know what happens after you die? The tape recorder shuts off. That's it. Because there's nothing else. All you are is a product of your DNA, which means you're a physical being with organs, a body, flesh and bones, and then when the time's up, the time's up. It's an incredibly frightening way to live your life. And I have to give him credit. He really believed this, and he was a pretty virtuous person. He was not an evil person, as the person I'm about to tell you about was. This way of thinking has a name. It's called reductive materialism. Anyone ever hear of that concept? Okay. So it's a yes? No, right? What is reductive materialism? It's a fancy word. And what it means is, there's a school of thought, and this will be something, again, you'll be exposed to. Don't fall for it. That's my agenda, right? My agenda is to counter-argue this philosophy. And it is a philosophy that has a very strong foothold. So you have to really give legitimate arguments. What I want from you guys is be objective. Right, we all, most of us, let's say, will have an agenda to make my side win. But I'm very interested in seeing how you feel about the arguments. Now, the warning I gave you about if you come today, you got to come next week, is because first we're going to build up his side of the discussion. We're going to explain to you where this doctor was coming from, and what was his agenda, what was his debate, what was his information that he was throwing at me where he demanded that I counter-argue. That might take us the whole time today. By the way, what is the whole time today? Until?
Seven.
Definitely, it almost certainly is going to take the whole time today. We'll try to leave enough room so I don't kill everybody's Rosh Hashanah with these horrible ideas. But probably the thrust of the argument is going to happen a week from now. But we'll do our best. You can read through the handout, maybe you can figure it out yourself. One of the major proponents of reductive materialism was a person named Francis Crick. Who has heard of that person? Who's he?
Yeah, Watson and Crick.
Yes, he is the Crick of Watson and Crick, one of the person who won the Nobel Prize for telling us what DNA, the double helix model of DNA. You don't have to worry about that. But it's not a coincidence that the guy who is heavy into DNA is going to be heavy into this idea of reductive materialism, because he's going to maintain that all we are is a product of our DNA, and he knows that DNA is quite impressive. What he could show is coming out of your DNA, right? So he's going to say everything about you comes out of your DNA. Now, the fact that our bodies physically comes out of DNA, that's not such a chiddush to any of us. That's not in any way a threat. But he's going to tell me more than that. He's going to say not only is your body coming out of DNA, he's going to say your personality comes out of your DNA, your sense of humor is from your DNA, your intellect to some degree,
he would say totally comes out of it. Your every component of you. So we have to see how this works out. I'll just, to quote, he wrote a book called The Astonishing Hypothesis. Don't read it. I'm telling you not to read it. Right? To me, it's a horrible philosophy, and I'll show you the consequences of this philosophy in a moment. But basically, this quote summarizes what he says. You, your joys, your sorrows, your memories, your ambitions, your sense of personal identity, your free will, oh my God, right? Free will is the very sacred territory of the neshama, right? He's telling me even your free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Unbelievable. Good timing, right? He's really telling me that everything I think or feel is in my brain. Unbelievable. What's the consequence if you really believe this? So what is the consequence in terms of the sanctity of life? Is life sacred? Is there anything holy about a human life if you really take this to its full, complete conclusion? No. Let me just say this one last thing, then I'll take the question. I want to just show you the consequence. This same person, Francis Crick, who you're going to get the idea, I don't like at all, right? I don't. He's not alive anymore, but I still don't like him. I like him better dead than alive. Here's the consequence. You'll see why in a moment I'm being so harsh. He says the following. This is, if you look on the paragraph where the arrow is. Dr. Crick inferred that we cannot continue to regard all human life as sacred. The idea that every person has a soul and that his life must be saved at all costs should not be allowed. Instead, the status of birth and death should be reconsidered. If, for example, a child were considered to be legally born alive, in other words, when 2 days old, it could be examined to see whether it was an acceptable member of human society. Does everyone understand what that means? That means that according to Dr. Crick, what we should do, we are going to arbitrarily define life as beginning at 48 hours. Right? Everybody knows about the abortion debate. You know, does life begin at conception or is a fetus alive? Forget that. We don't have to worry about fetuses. He wants to say a 24-hour, 48-hour-year-old baby is not alive yet. What will that allow him to do? Unbelievable. He could check out the baby, or get his medical team. They'll check out the baby. If it's defective, kill it. Is that murder? No. Why? We just define life as beginning tomorrow. Since I'm defining life as beginning tomorrow, I'm not killing anything. It's not alive yet. And he doesn't spare us at the other end of life either. I won't read it inside. You can read it yourselves. But he says we're going to define life ends at 80, 85. What does that mean? So that means a person hits, right? Your grandfather, your great-grandfather hits the age of 80. Guess what? He might be swimming from Cuba to Florida. It doesn't make a difference. The guy's dead. He's dead. What's the ramification? Well, if you live in England, anybody from England? Okay, don't take this the wrong way. But in England, there's like a scarcity of resources, medical resources, right? You aware of that? Socialized medicine? Same thing in this country, right? So whatever, but if you say they're dead at 80, then you don't waste any of that good stuff on them, because they're dead already. You don't. What's the point of doing dialysis to a dead person? What's the point of treating a dead person? In fact, very, very interesting, this guy Crick, this was the irony of it. And this is where I lost respect for him. I'll tell you the truth. He's entitled to his opinion. He has this reductive, materialistic outlook on life, which I find abhorrent, as we'll see more and more. But it's his opinion. He's a scientist. He's acting out of what he's trained to do. I can understand it. I don't like it. I can understand it. I can even understand his conclusions as vile as they sound to us. But here's where I really lost respect to him. My brother is a neurologist, and he has a lab. And in his lab, one of the people in his lab was a student of Dr. Crick and was very close with him, stayed in touch with him. When he was in his 80s, he became ill. So my brother asked his friend, who was the student, he was in touch with him, he said, hey, I'm just so curious. He's 80, is he getting any medical treatments? Absolutely. Fully taking advantage of all the medical therapy available. So now he's a hypocrite too, right? I mean, he's dead. What's he taking all that medical therapy? So at the end of the day, reductive materialism is out there, it could be very, very dangerous, and it has to be contended with. It has to be counter-argued. Now, how do you argue with somebody who believes in this? So here's what's important. There's three components to the argument. There's three components to our response. One is going to be, I need to understand them really well. Right? You know, this is something that's good advice for life. In any debate you ever get into on any topic, whether it be Lomdus in a Gemara, right? You really got to know the issue. You want to know about Chaynos et Atzmo. You got to know the fundamentals of Chaynos et Atzmo. You got to start from the bottom, build up, and have a full understanding of it. So number one, and that's what we're going to spend a lot of time on today, where do they get this notion from? What are their proofs that we don't have a soul, right? They're not guessing it. They're trying to prove it. And they have certain objective, what they consider objective, hard evidence that this is so. I'm going to show you it. That's the part that's scary, that I don't want anyone getting anxious about and losing it over it, right? Anyone who feels they won't be able to handle it should leave, and I mean it sincerely. I won't take it personally, and it might be in your best interest to do it. Anyone leave? Okay, very gutsy guys. Okay, good. I will guarantee you that I think I have a very strong counter-argument that's going to demolish their proofs. Right? Now, if I'm going to do that, how should I do it? Should I do it wholly through the Torah? In other words, step two, I'm going to tell you what our traditional Orthodox understanding, Chazal's understanding of the Neshama is. I'm going to show you where Chazal believes the Neshama, or not where, but where it is in us, but how the Neshama develops and exactly what Chazal attributes to the Neshama. What parts of our being is the Neshama and what parts of our being is physical. I will show you that. But will that be enough to counter-argue with these guys? What do I need to do?
Sign evidence.
Yes, I got to get them from their perspective. So that's going to be part three. That's the part I don't want you to miss because I think it's very important. I'm going to give you the Torah's view of it, which I think is enough. But I don't want anyone leaving with any doubts. I'm going to show you objective scientific proof that will counter anything I'm about to tell you right now. Everybody got it? I'm very nervous about this, you can tell. I don't want anyone being hurt by anything I say. Right? This should be a spiritually uplifting experience, not a damaging one. So that means two things. You got to stay to the end, even if you're never going to come again. This particular one, you need to come today and next week. And two, anything that still bothers you, please come and ask me either publicly or privately.
I want to go back to the spots right here, a quick statement.
Yes.
How does he believe that our personality comes from the DNA if a lot of times we are subject to change or a product of our environment?
It's been studied.
I don't understand. It's in our DNA that we can't change personality.
Is that true?
I don't know. If a
personality is in the DNA. Gage? Phineas Gage. Okay. Who heard of Phineas Gage? Who took a psych course? Every psych course talks about Phineas Gage. I'm going to answer you, I promise, very fully. It's a great question. It's perfect for what I'm about to show you. You'll see, because we're going to deal with that. If you turn the page, we're now going to go through, just this top half is all the evidence that they'll use to confront. Most of it is neurological clinical evidence, where they're going to show all the things that I have attributed to the Neshama. What do you need? A handout? Are there any handouts lying around? I don't have any left. Any extra ones? We'll make you another one. We'll do that. This top half is going to give you a whole bunch of qualities. I think there's seven that we normally would attribute to the Neshama. And they're going to show me, they're going to prove to me, this is exactly what this mentor of mine hit me with as his arguments. Right? He had me tell him, what is the Neshama? He says, there's a Neshama. Tell me what the soul is doing. So I said, well, you know, Chazal say, HaNeshama Medaberes. It's the ability to speak, to communicate. Not only to speak and give off communication, but receptive communication as well. That's all part of the Neshama. So he says, really? He says, what happens if somebody has a stroke, Rahman al-Atlan, on their left dominant hemisphere of their brain? Anyone know? Anyone ever see, unfortunately, somebody who's had a stroke? What's one of the first things to go?
Speech.
Most dramatic thing to go is their speech. And it's not only their ability to speak mechanically, but their ability to receive and understand and comprehend. Receptive language is also damaged. Is that a Ryan Mufrachas, that the speech, language, is not something that the soul is participating in? The fact that a person, this is what he was telling me, I got you already. Person who has a stroke, right? The brain knocks out the ability to speak. The brain knocks out the ability to understand and comprehend. Must be the brain, not the soul. Why is that a terrible argument? This one's going to be easy. We're going to knock it out right now. And the same thing for number two over here, vision. There's a part of the brain called the occipital lobe. The occipital lobe is the visual cortex, where visual information comes in through your eyes, and it's assimilated in your brain, in your occipital lobe. If someone, Rahman al-Tsan, has a stroke in their occipital lobe, they won't be able to see. Sometimes they think they can. It gets very interesting. My brother once took me on grounds, neurological grounds. I don't want to knock the field of neurology, but I got to say, it's one of the earliest things that I ruled out. I would never be a neurologist. It seems that what they do 99% of the time is have fun with diagnosis. And what I mean by fun, it's going to sound a little cruel, but they have so many fascinating things going on with their patients. Like, for example, he had me come in with this woman who had a stroke in her occipital lobe. She thought she could see, but she couldn't because the brain that is vision was damaged. So we go in and he says to her, you know, just, can you see? She says, yes. She's completely blind. He says, well, describe what I'm wearing. So she starts to describe what he's wearing. He's wearing probably at that time, you know, a white coat, you know, like a real doctor getup, right? She says, oh, you're wearing a flowered shirt and like some description. None of it had anything to do with what he was wearing, but she thought she could see. But she couldn't because the part of the brain that's vision was out. Now, the part of the brain that's vision's out, the part of the brain that's language is out, does that disprove that there's a neshama involved in vision? That my neshama is seeing you right now? That my neshama is communicating with you right now? Tell me why not. Who can give me a simple analogy that really just knocks that whole argument off the table? Who here has seen a corded telephone? A telephone with a cord. Okay, great. I just didn't know if that was still out there. Right? What's special about a corded telephone? It has a cord. So let's say I'm on the telephone talking to somebody, right? And somebody, my little kid, one of my kids comes over and cuts the cord. Will I be able to communicate with that person I was talking to any longer?
No.
No. Is it because I can't speak?
No.
Because I can't understand? No, it's because the kli that was facilitating the communication is broken. That's exactly the way to understand and demolish that argument. It's a stupid argument, right? My neshama is at the end, it's the end point of that communication, or the originating point of that communication. The kli, which is the brain, the auditory parts of the brain, the visual parts of the brain, that's what's out. So that's easy, right? Anyone now have any problems with that argument? Does that argument prove anything? Absolutely not.
Okay, so how can we, the logic would apply, how do we, okay, so why is it not going to the brain?
No, in other words, I haven't proven that there isn't a neshama yet. I'm not trying to do that. But he's telling me, he got all excited. He says, because he knew there is a very famous idea in Chazal that one of the absolute hallmarks of the neshama is that it's involved in dibur. Dibur is a function of the neshama, right? So, stupidly, I said that as my first thing. But when we had our debate, I said, well, speech, communication, that is a soul characteristic. That's a soul activity. My neshama is involved in that. So he says, really? So how come I'm going to tell you it's not your soul, it's just the brain? And he tried to prove it by the stroke data, but the stroke data is stupid because it doesn't take away the fact that my neshama is still here. The kli through which my neshama hears in this world is damaged. That's all it means. Right? The blind man or the deaf man in the story, in the song, right? His neshama is there. Does he have a neshama? Of course he has a neshama. He can't hear. Why can't he hear? Because I don't know. He has his eighth cranial nerve is damaged. That's the nerve that's dealing with hearing, right? Or the inner ear is damaged, so he can't hear. Or the part of his brain that helps him. But that's just the kli. Hear it? he has a neshama that, released from the obstacle of his body, would allow him to hear. That's my belief, right? That's Jewish belief. So this raya of theirs is not very compelling, right? Where they get stronger is in some of the other areas. Intellect. Now, who knows anything about the brain? Anyone here study the brain at all? You're only in high school. Well, how much can you know, right? So the brain has two hemispheres, left and right, a dominant hemisphere and a non-dominant hemisphere, right? The left is dominant, we'll see what that means in a second, and the right is non-dominant. What are the, what's the job of the left hemisphere? Anyone know? Language, we just said it, that's one major thing. Logic, reading, the ability to read is coming from your left hemisphere. What's the right hemisphere, the non-dominant hemisphere doing? What? Excellent. Exactly. Music, art, appreciation of color. Right? Now, all those things I just attributed to the brain, but I'm going to tell you that it's your neshama that experiences that. Your neshama experiences an appreciation of art. Your neshama appreciates music. Your neshama discerns colors, and the colors have an effect on your neshama. Right? So he says to me, that's the stupidest thing in the world, then he'll prove it. How's he going to prove it? So he proves it first with the following data. He says, no, it's 100% just your brain. How are you going to prove it? So he says, well, there's a condition of seizures that some people have, Rahman al-Nitzan, that's called intractable seizures, where you can't do anything treating it. The only way to treat it is to separate. Exactly. Is to, how do you know that? Very good. Is to sever the corpus callosum. The corpus callosum is the thing that connects the two sides of your brain. So what happens to people that, and it's very rare to have to do this, but if somebody needs to do that in order to stop seizures, what happens is they like have separated two brains. And it's like two people living inside one body. So he says, you see, it's two people because they have a split brain, not because they have two neshamos, right? It's a person with one neshama. What do you think of that one?
You can say the same thing, yeah. Which is that the clean vessel is in the
trauma
is perfect.
Well, I want to volunteer. Who wants to volunteer to go through that experiment that we just described? Okay. Come on. Right? We're not gonna split his corpus callosum. But we're gonna do something else. I have a sheet. And on it, I wrote six colors, right? I'm going to have you read the six colors, right, for everybody. They come up here. Each color is written in a different color. So first you're going to read them based on the color. Not read the words, just say the color. Okay. All six as fast as you can. And then you're going to do the same thing, reading the words, okay? You guys judge if there's any difference between the way he does it, and somebody explain to me if there is a difference, why. Okay? Let me just show you what he's going to read. When you're reading this, right? Remember, first thing you need to do is what?
Read the color.
Say the color. Okay. But you have to do it in a way, sorry. You know what? You face me. We want everyone to see that you get it right. Make sure he's getting it right. Go.
Okay. Purple, red, blue, black,
loud.
Orange. Yellow.
How do you do? Okay. Now read it.
Yellow, green, red, white, blue, purple.
Which was first? Were you? Second one definitely was. Usually it's more dramatic. We'll have to have a talk later.
Right hemisphere.
But it was clearly even in him.
No. I mean left hemisphere.
Oh, yes. Very good job. Why did that happen, and what is my point? Why did that happen? Correct. What does that mean? If he's reading the words, so he's using his left dominant side. If he's looking at the colors, he's using his right non-dominant side. But what happens when you're looking at the colors and it's contradicted by the dominant side? You're confused. You can't necessarily do it well. What's the point of this little experiment? So it's again evidence that, you know, cognition, reading, comprehension even, color appreciation is just a function of the physical brain. Okay? It's a very sort of simple but kind of effective demonstration of that fact. That is interesting enough, but what's really amazing on their side are the next three riots. This I couldn't believe until I saw it with my own eyes. Awareness of environment. I know I am standing here in this room, right, with all you guys, right? It's one of my favorite places to be, right? Here I am in this room. I know exactly where I am. I have bookshelves on the left side. All you guys are on my left side. I have the windows on my right side, and all you guys are on my right side. Somebody, Rahman al-Islam, who has a right parietal stroke, it doesn't matter where it is, but you probably know, right? Right parietal stroke, will lose the ability to be aware of half his environment. Sounds crazy, right? What does that mean? That means if we came into his room, which I did with my brother on his neurological funny games, right? I come in, and there's a person with that type of stroke, and he fails to see, right? We're all standing. It's a whole group of doctors standing around. And just like you, make believe it's you, right? He will recognize the existence of all of you. You, to him, do not exist. If we ask him to draw a clock, you know what he'll do? What do you think he'll do?
Half a clock. He'll do this. This part of the world doesn't exist. He has no, because of a damaged part of his brain, he loses awareness of half of his environment. That's really getting scared. Huh? Whatever way he's facing that half of the world, if you map it out, you know, with a compass, he's not existing. Now, it gets even more crazy. This one really blew me away. Awareness of your own body. This is my arm, this is my other arm, my left leg, my right leg. My neshama is aware of that, right? It's a sense of awareness that your neshama has. That couldn't be my brain that's aware of that, right? Because another stroke is the last stroke, I promise. Right? Let me just finish this. Anyone who's getting nervous, don't be nervous. I'm telling you, this is nothing. In the end, it's nothing. For the moment, it's quite compelling and quite scary, but here's what happens. We go into the room, there's this woman who had this stroke, and she doesn't know any longer the existence of the left side of her body. To her, she does not have this. She has no left leg and no left arm. How do we find that out? Well, the first thing we say to her, my brother says to her, why are you here in the hospital? She goes, and this is a personal experience. I don't know. I don't know what they're keeping me here for. I'm fine. Maybe they want my money. That's really what she said. So my brother said, yeah, okay. Goes over to her, lifts up her arm, and says to her, what's this? She goes, that's an arm. He goes, whose arm? She goes, I don't know, yours, doc? He puts it down on the table. We walk out. As we're walking out, she screams out, hey, doc, you forgot your arm. Right? Because she sees the arm. She has no awareness, because of the damage from the stroke, she has no awareness of the fact that that's her arm. So, wow. Doesn't that imply something? That implies that the actual awareness of our own bodies is something that's physically being manipulated or being produced, acted out by the brain. And the final one is your question. Finally, and we'll have 5 minutes to try and save ourselves, right? Personality. Isn't personality your neshama, right? There are good people, there are bad people, there are funny people, there are depressed people, there are crazy people, all sorts of personalities out there. Is that coming from your brain or your neshama? So it's a hotly debated issue for a long time, and along comes Phineas Gage. Who's Phineas Gage? For those who never heard of him, Phineas Gage was a guy who worked on the railroad. And he was known to be a really nice guy, a real gentleman, kind, compassionate, right? Good guy, like a Schreiber guy, right? So there he is, he's working on the train, and what did he used to do? He used to set up these blast charges. And the way they used to do it is they used to pat down gunpowder into this tube, right? But the chop was, put some
a buffer material between the gunpowder and the metal rod to protect yourself. So one day he's doing it and they forgot the whatever the buffer was.
Shot.
He goes down with the metal rod into the gunpowder. What do you think happens?
Ignited.
Explosion. Right through his eye, through his brain, goes the metal rod. Miraculously, he survives. However, right? Undergo surgery, whatever that meant back in the 19th century, and he's a new person. His personality changes dramatically. And all the neuroscientists and psychologists go to town, because a lot of them are skeptics, and they think they just proved there's no soul. Why? Because look, he was this kind, very nice person, that was his personality, to be a tzaddik. And a little physical injury to his brain changes it all. So my first reaction was, well, maybe he's a little upset about having an iron thing go through his brain. You know, maybe that's what changes his personality. But the problem with that simple answer is not enough, because they controlled for that, because this thing is something that he maintained for a little while. Now we'll see what happens. Now it's a real shame that I can't, I mean, I'd love to give away the answer and the punchline now to make everybody feel better. I'm tempted to do it because we're going to Rosh Hashanah. I don't want anyone to go in with any negative feelings about the neshama. But the real way to go about now, that's the end of their arguments, by the way, right? They think they have physical evidence that we don't have the neshama because all these qualities that we would have given from the neshama, they've proven is located in the brain. The question is, how compelling is that? What does Chazal have to say about it? So just to give you an overview to take with you and feel better, Chazal 100% fully recognize the reality of everything we said. I'm going to show you in Chazal, every point that was just made is present right there. So that's going to be number one. It's going to be immediately disarming for any fears. Do you hear what I'm saying? Nothing we just talked about, Chazal were unaware of. We're going to show how Chazal saw all of these characteristics, including personality. There's a Gemara, if you want to look it up. There's a Gemara in which Masechta? Shabbos, of all places. Kuf Nun Vav. It's not in the handout. I'm thinking about it right now. It's a very important Yisod. It's not in this handout, but since we're learning Shabbos, I'll throw one out. Take a look at that Gemara. You'll see that Chazal will say all the personality characteristics are in your DNA. So what does that say about Bechira? What does that say about Neshama? What does that say about Tshuva? What does it say? Anyone have a quick answer? Just curious. Before we end. Does it obviate all the fundamentals of Judaism, that fact? It certainly shouldn't. If it's in the Gemara, you know, like you have to think there's got to be some understanding here that's very important. So we're going to develop this very, very fully, but just to give you food for thought, whatever you have in your DNA, you know, there's a Gemara that we're going to look at in Nida that says Hashem takes the sperm, the zera of a person, Shas Pekida is called, and he decides that, this is what the Gemara says, he decides this person is going to be brilliant, this person is going to be not so brilliant, this person is going to be a great basketball player, this person is not going to be such a great basketball player, this person is going to be incredibly powerful, this person is going to be angry, this person is going to be having a great sense of humor, right? The Gemara says that's all in your DNA, that's what that means. When it says Hashem decides it, that's how he, how does Hashem decide it? Because you're born that way. So what? And then what happens? So then your neshama's got to work with that and do something with it. That's where we're headed. That's what you have to understand. Now, I have to tell you this part because I want you to go into Rosh Hashanah realizing that this is the fundamental message of the entire Zman of Yamim Narayim. Yamim Narayim, if you look at the Rambam very carefully, Hilchos Tshuva, Perek Zayin, is all about emphasizing this fact and this reality. Whatever characteristic you are, right? Real tshuva is not just about averos. You did little sins. I'm going to do tshuva because I'm never going to do aver again. That's like everyday tshuva all year long. That's baby tshuva. Real tshuva is you take whatever kelim you were given, whatever capacity, whatever personality even, and you perfect it. You become a malach. That's tshuva. That's called tshuva de geula. That's the ultimate goal for every Jew during this period. We will, Be'ezras Hashem, show you, dissect this out through the sources in Chazal, but ultimately I'm going to show you contemporary science has come our way. Be'ezras Hashem. Shana Tova. Baruch Hashem.
Appropriate.
Yeah, so that's useful.